As many of you know, this is a paper much like last year's paper on Camus, Stein, and Empathy in the Stranger. This is part of a bigger project that I'm slowly working on with regards to Camus, Stein, and Empathy. Right, so whilst there is no mention of the phenomenology or ethics of Edith Stein in the fiction and nonfiction of Albert Camus, one can easily surmise that Camus, being a part of the Parisian cafe scene during the years leading up to, including and beyond the Second World War, would have encountered some of the discussions of Stein's thought through Jean-Paul Sartre or Maurice Merleau-Ponty, prior to his falling out with both men. It is then the purpose of this paper to set out and accomplish several things. I'd like to offer readers a concise summary of Stein's principal text on empathy, and I would like to offer an exposition and an analysis of Stein's concept of empathy from a phenomenological perspective in Camus' novel, The Plague. As I plan to illustrate, the novel contains six major and minor characters: Dr. Bernard Rieu, Father Panelot, Jean Tarrou, Raymond Rambert, Joseph Grant, and Cotter, from which Camus utilizes in order to demonstrate an individual's interaction with empathy in the midst of an epidemic. However, I'd like to first look at Stein in order to provide the framework for the novel's analysis. On the Problem of Empathy is a clarification of Husserl's ideas of empathy, which Stein in turn receives from Theodor Lips, who first writes about empathy and its connections to aesthetics and psychology in his 1903 work, Leitfaden der Psychologie, or Guide to Psychology. Husserl and Lips would become close colleagues, so it is understandable that Stein would come to know Lips's philosophy through Husserl. With regards to empathy, Stein expands on Lips's theories and moves away from Husserl's transcendental phenomenological interpretation of the individual and brings forward her notions that the ability to empathize is one element that binds humans together. In their collection of essays on Husserl and Stein, Richard Feist and William Sweet tell us that empathy is, quote, an important issue for phenomenologists, end quote, and that it is, quote, central to philosophical analysis in understanding how other people see things and each other, end quote. While Descartes argues that doubting is the primary truth of philosophy and it constitutes the basis from which all philosophical thought is to derive, I would argue that from a non-existential point of view, phenomenology is situated in a unique position because it affords individuals to understand one another through empathy. And it is empathetic understanding that can bring individuals close to understanding the other rather than judging them. For Stein, like Jean-Paul Sartre afterwards, the ego is central to the issue of intersubjectivity in addition to empathy. Like the Anglo-Irish writers of the early 20th century, namely Virginia Woolf and James Joyce, Stein's usage of the ego as the I employs a stream of consciousness construction of the person. By doing so, Stein personalizes the empathetic experience and, as I will demonstrate in this paper, this is something that Camus utilizes in his fiction, despite neglecting to mention Stein in The Myth of Sisyphus. In her introduction to the phenomenological basis for empathy, Stein holds that, quote, the living body of the I is one that senses, thinks, feels, and wills, end quote. It is, quote, itself the center of orientation of such a phenomenal world. It faces this world and communicates with me, end quote. It is our I, part and parcel with the ego, that is our individuality and that allows us to perceive the world before us. Coming to know our ego and thus our I, we are able then to relate to ourselves and with the outside world. Since empathy deals with grasping what is here and now, it is possible for every experience to be primordially given. Empathy, according to Stein, quote, is a kind of act of perceiving and is the experience of foreign consciousness in general, irrespective of the kind of experience subject or of the subject whose consciousness is experienced, end quote. Empathy is the act by which our consciousness comes to know and understand the consciousness of the other. However, we cannot directly know the other's consciousness because it is not ours. Thus, empathy is the non-primordial experience that announces a primordial one. Judy Miles clarifies that individuals cannot directly empathize with another individual because the empathetic act is one that bridges the primordial experience of the other with what would be our secondary experience. And it is impossible to share primordial experiences as they are unique to and only to the individual experiencing them, even if there are two individuals experiencing the same situation at precisely the exact same moment. For example, two individuals are sitting on a couch chatting about a current event and an earthquake strikes. Even if both individuals are deathly afraid of earthquakes, their experiences are going to be as unique as they are and will only be individualized for their individual self. They can share in the experience, i.e. the shared experience. However, the empathetic moment will be individualized to the particular individual. I'd like to pause briefly and look at what would appear to be a passing comment by Stein as she moves from her discussion of the I and empathy towards a transition to the foreign individual. Quote, the physical body occurs as a living body. Consciousness occurs as the soul of the unified individual, end quote. I'd like to briefly examine the second clause in the statement. For Stein, consciousness occurs as the soul is unified with the individual. Here, the key word is unified. In my analysis of Camus' characters, I will argue that part of their ability to empathize will be rooted in the unification between the individual and the other. When we look at Camus' fiction, we see that, in short, we cannot know what the characters experience, nor understand those experiences. We can only speculate. Camus' second published novel, The Plague, centers around the ominous events of an epidemic in Oran, Algeria, in April of 1940-something or other. Structurally, the novel consists of five parts that are reminiscent of an ancient Greco-Roman tragedy, where there is an introduction or background, rising action set up over the course of the next three parts or acts, and finally the climax and conclusion in the final part. The six characters, three major and three minor, seem to mirror different age groups, demographics, and societal responses to the epidemic, which begins as bubonic plague and then quickly evolves into a pneumonic-based plague. Readers are introduced to an anonymous narrator, whom we later discover is no other than the novel's protagonist, Dr. Bernard Rieu. Father Panelo is the learned Jesuit priest. Jean Tarrou is a French traveler who has come to Algeria from Franco-fascist Spain. Raymond Rambert is a young journalist who has been sent on assignment from his newspaper to report on the Arab condition in the interior Algeria. And Grand and Cotard. Grand is a widower who happens to be a struggling novelist, and Cotard runs the black market after his suicide attempt at the beginning of the novel. Whilst each of these characters seems to represent the prevailing attitudes of Iranians towards the plague and the ensuing quarantine and lockdown, they also represent Camus' vision of society's engagement with the absurd, as well as the different facets of society. For example, upon closer inspection, readers will notice that Rieu symbolizes science and reason, whereas Panelo is juxtaposed against Rieu as the symbol of feeling. Tarrou and Rambert represent the youth of society.
Represent the youth of society.
In his mid-30s, and the latter being innocent, as he is merely concerned with returning to Paris and his lover. Both are visitors to and not residents of Oran, so they come to also represent the stranger outsider aspect of the novel. Grand and Cotter are the oldest of the six men, and they come to symbolize the journalist artist at work in Grand, and Cotter's blatant disregard for the welfare of society. His attitude is one of a self-serving grandioseness that will come to be perfected in the fall. In their own ways, each of these six characters, no matter how major or minor they are, will come to be involved with some form of Stein's empathy. In the beginning of the novel, Rieu is forced to send his wife to a sanatorium in the mountains for the sake of her health. The parallels to 2020 and the isolation of individuals in convalescent hospitals separated from their loved ones during the COVID-19 pandemic are striking, not to mention the allegory that the sanatorium, like the isolation camps in Iran, is indicative of the Nazi concentration camps throughout Central and Eastern Europe. It is then that the plague slowly rears its head and strikes Iran, thus putting Ryu on the front line as an essential worker, and as of only one of two or three doctors named in the novel. He is the very representation of being stoic, and some readers might mistake his stoicism for being unsympathetic or unempathetic. According to Alma Amoya, over the course of the epidemic, Ryu, quote, has grown tired of showing pity, realizing that pity is useless, but he nevertheless continues his professional efforts unflinchingly, end quote. The first thing that should be noted is that as a doctor, Ryu is a scientist, and as a scientist, he is a pragmatist and rational. He knows full well that pity will not aid in the alleviation of the plague, but instead it will be rational thinking grounded in science and medicine. Also, one could argue that as an atheist, Ryu has far less patience for pity and prayers than a theist. In many respects, this alone will preclude empathetic connections because of the inability to, and some might argue, unwillingness to form a connection with the individual who is fearful of the plague and puts his or her trust solely into God's hands. One striking feature is that Ryu seems to be emotionless, and while he is often mistaken for his unsympathetic demeanor, readers should be aware that as a physician, he must separate himself from his patients. It is not a question of whether or not Ryu is unsympathetic or even, oh, sorry, it is not a question of whether or not Ryu is unempathetic or even unsympathetic, but rather it is an instance where one must understand that Ryu, in being a doctor, knows full well that death is inevitable and inescapable. Thus, instead of focusing his energy on prayer, he chooses to direct his energy on using medicine to the best of his ability in order to try and save as many people as possible. Again, according to Amoya, since Ryu does not believe in God, Taru now asks, why does he show so much devotion to a higher principle? The physician's answer is that since he does not believe in an all-powerful God who will take care of the sick, he must do it himself, struggling with all his might against death and without raising his eyes from his work to seek help from the stubbornly silent heavens, end quote. It is Ryu's belief that there is no God to pray to believe in, or to assume responsibility for the horrors of the plague. Then it is his duty as a doctor to do it himself. It is in his mindset that allows himself to struggle, quote, with all his might against death without raising his eyes from his work to seek help from the stubbornly silent heavens, end quote, and along with Taru, quote, set their shoulders to the wheel again, end quote. This is not a question of Ryu's lack of sympathy or empathy. Instead, it is one where he does not delude himself into thinking that a higher power will intercede on his behalf. Ryu rationalizes the notion that if there is no God to intervene on the Iranians' behalf, so he must take it upon himself to do everything in his power to fight the plague for the sake of the city. Juxtaposed against Ryu's rationalistic approach is Panelo. As the learned Jesuit priest of Iran and a man tending to the spiritual needs of its citizens, Camus places Panelo in a unique position in that he should be able to shepherd his congregation and help assuage their fears with compassionate understanding. The empathy and sympathy that Panelo lacks makes him a prime target for the venting of Ryu's frustration, as well as leaving readers to scratch their heads in wonder at his ineptitude. When Panel lambastes the congregation during his first sermon, he tells his flock that the plague, quote, was assuredly a sign of God's wrath at Iran's impiety, end quote. Regardless as to whether or not Panelo is extolling the virtues of St. Augustine, which will be examined shortly, Matthew Sharp deduces that Panelo's first sermon during the plague is one in which blame is squared placely at the feet and on the shoulders of the citizens for their unwillingness to set themselves in the face of being good Christians. To be fair, however, one must look at Ryu's description prior to the first sermon. For example, quote, there were large attendees at the service of the week of prayer. It must not, however, be assumed that in normal times the townsfolk of Iran are particularly devout. On Sunday mornings, for instance, sea bathing competes seriously with church going, nor must it be thought that they had seen a great light and had a sudden change of heart. Thus, they felt under no obligation to make any change in their habits as yet, end quote. It is as if, from a superficial point of view, that the Iranians are merely going through the motions, so to speak, regarding their weekend routines. For the ordinary citizen, it is not a question of whether or not to go to mass, but it is a question of choosing hedonism over piety. Sea bathing and sunbathing, for that matter, can be seen in Camusian terms as negligent of Christian worship and, instead, are elements of nature worship, where the sea and the sun become objects of idolatry instead of the reverent veneration of the Judeo-Christian God. During Panelo's first sermon, there is a complete absence of empathy for Iran and its citizens. Quote, for plague is the flail of God and the world his threshing floor, and implacably he will thresh out his harvest until the wheat is separated from the chaff. Repentance was enough, men though, nothing was forbidden. For a long while, God gazed down on this town with eyes of compassion, but he grew very weary of waiting. His eternal hope was too long deferred, and now he turned his face away from us. And so, God's light withdrawn, we walk in darkness, in the thick darkness of this plague. My brothers, he cried, that fatal hunt is up and harrying our streets today. See him there? The angel of pestilence, comely as Lucifer, shining like evil's very self. He is hovering above your roofs with his great spear in his right hand poised to strike, while his left hand is stretched out toward one or other of your houses. Yes, the hour has come for some serious thought. You fondly imagined it was enough to visit God on Sundays and thus could make you free of your weekdays. You believed some brief formalities, some bendings of the knee would recompense him well enough for your criminal indifference. But God is not mocked. These brief encounters could not state the fierce hunger of his love. Now you are learning your lesson, the lesson that was learned by Cain and his offspring, by the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, by Job and Pharaoh, and all that hardened their hearts against him, end quote. In the first part of the sermon, Panelo chooses to lay blame for the plague squarely at God's feet, inciting that the Iranians are the ones who have caused him to become so angry and tired of waiting for sinners to repent. The plague is sent as a means to punish Iran. The allegorical connections to the Old Testament tales of plagues visiting Egypt or God's wrath upon Sodom and Gomorrah are not lost on the reader. In his essay, Panelo's Turn, an analysis of the sermons in the plague, Eric Berg argues that, quote, Panelo holds to a firm Augustinian line based on the supreme will of God as an answer to the plague in the first sermon, end quote. I do not choose this quote to argue the validity of Augustine's summation, nor do I choose it to help support the idea that Panelo is an Augustinian scholar. But rather, I choose it as a way to support my claim that in taking Augustine literally, Panelo either directly or indirectly chooses to uphold a theology that lacks any kind of empathetic awareness. And I can see Eric cringing. According to Ron Shrigley, quote, Panelo wishes to see things as they are, good and evil both, without the dialectics and easy consolations of his earlier Augustinianism. But he refuses to renounce his faith in God. The question is whether it is possible to hold these two things together, end quote. Here, Shrigley holds that Panelo chooses an either-or dichotomy with regards to Panelo's theodicy, which, it should be noted, also does not allow for the existence of empathy. Panelo sees the world in starkly black and white terms, and by doing so, thus prevents a narrow-minded perspective on the world and the human condition. Even if it is clear that Panelot functions as the theological voice for Camus, he wants to address the question of universal human suffering in the face of evil from several perspectives. And Panelot's is the religious perspective. Nevertheless, this formulation will attempt to shift the blame from God to the human agent, but it moves quickly to contradiction. When Panelot shifts blame from God to the citizens of Iran, two things happen. Firstly, he moves responsibility away from God's benevolence and onto the Iranians. Thus, accountability is moved from the creator and placed onto the creatures. And secondly, when this happens, both God is off the hook, and so is Panelot, as he acts as the intermediary between God and Iran. And this is noted when he chooses you as the primary pronoun in that first sermon. And if one takes the analysis a step further, then Panelot acts as a kind of Pontius Pilate to the martyrdom of the perceived blasphemous Iranians who choose not to be reverent in their daily lives. What Camus does is masterly weave elements of the Old Testament lore with New Testament symbolism in order to construct an allegorical novel that demonstrates that the priest, who should by all accounts be empathetic towards his flock, is nothing more than a critique of the hypocrisy of the Catholic Church. Of the three major characters in the play, Taru is the final character to be analyzed. Taru, more than any other character in the novel, comes to represent the epitome of the individual who exhibits qualities of empathy in his daily work. Taru remains a cryptic character through the first three parts of the novel, and it is not until readers come to part four that they really get to know and understand who Taru really is. For example, he tells Ryu that his father was a judge in France, and that he was prepared to follow in his father's footsteps and go into law. However, witnessing the pleasure that his father takes in handing down a death sentence repulses him and forces him to leave France for Spain, where he fights on the side of the Republicans against Franco's fascist regime. One could argue that the most pivotal moment in the novel is the death of the prefect's son, Jacques Othion. Jacques is a small child, possibly between 3 and 5 years old. His death is the only one described in minute detail and is a grotesque parody of the crucifixion. In the moments leading to Jacques' death, quote, Taru gently stroked with his big paw the small face stained with tears and sweat, end quote. While Jacques is dying from the plague and the ineffectiveness of Dr. Castel's first anti-plague serum, the Othion family is being held in one of the concentration camp-like quarantine camps. Thus, with Jacques' parents not by his bedside, Taru, the atheist, takes it upon himself to act like a surrogate parent, and by brushing his face, he provides a moment of empathetic comfort to Jacques. The reason I mention Taru's atheism is because it is Panelot who should be empathetic towards Jacques' death. It is Panelot who should be comforting the child as he makes the transition from life to death. Yet all Panelot can do is melodramatically fall to his knees and proclaim, quote, may God spare this child, end quote. I am well aware that some critics will see Panelot's exclamation as his sincerity. However, I would argue that given his past indifferences and damnations of the Iranians, that nothing has changed his demeanor. He is, in fact, the same arrogant priest who is using his position within the city to separate himself from the rest of the flock, thereby creating a hierarchy of religious salvation. This makes sense when readers come to Panelot's second sermon in part four and the cathedral is only 3/4 full. Panelot's tone has changed, but it is still lacking any kind of empathetic connection to the parishioners. Before I examine the role of empathy in Raymond Rambert, I would like to briefly mention there are no instances of empathy with two of the most minor characters in the novel, Grand and Cotter. If readers will recall, Grand is the older gentleman who represents the struggling artist in the novel, as he just cannot seem to get past the first few paragraphs of his novel. And Cotter is the shady black market dealing individual who is willing to acquire anything for a price and eventually loses his mind at the end of the novel when quarantine is lifted and the gates are open as he opens gunfire upon the square below his window. As mentioned earlier in the essay, Rambert is a newly married journalist from Paris who has been sent to Iran by his newspaper in order to cover the plague's outbreak. And the sanitary conditions amongst the Arab inhabitants. At the beginning of quarantine, Rambert is only concerned with getting back to Paris and into the waiting arms of his wife. He has absolutely no interest whatsoever of helping fight the plague. He goes so far as to attack Rieu, stating that, quote, "So I thought that in one case, anyhow, you could unmake what you'd helped to make. But you don't care. You never gave a thought to anybody, and you don't take the case of people who are separated into account," end quote. Even later, Rambert is trying to convince Rieu that his case for leaving is deemed special. Quote, "The gist of his argument was always the same, that he was a stranger to our town, and that being so, his case deserved special consideration," end quote. Clearly, Rambert is not interested in helping anyone but himself. And this is a moment when, instead of being empathetic or even sympathetic, he chooses to think only himself and transfer his self-loathing angst into a bitterness that is railed against Rieu. The differences between Rambert and Rieu are staggering. On the one hand, Rieu is the soft-spoken doctor who exhibits empathy just by the sheer weight of his job. On the other hand, Rambert comes to represent the youth of the times who seem only to care about his self-centered interests. Of course, all of this changes when Cotard's associates, Gomez, Gonzalez, Marcel, and Louis, are unable to procure Rambert's safe passage out of Iran. Rambert slowly sees the error of his ways and becomes more open to the idea of staying, helping, and fighting against the plague. He unhurriedly opens up to Rieu and Taru, and has discovered that earlier in his life, he also fought in the Spanish Civil War on the side of the Republicans, or as he refers to it, the losing side. Immediately after confessing his part against Franco's fascist regime, Rambert admits that it is courage that makes man capable of great deeds. This begins Rambert's transition from unempathetic to empathetic, and we see this in the evolution of his demeanor when Rambert sprang off his bed, his face ablaze with passion. Man is an idea, and is a precious small idea once he turns his back on love. And that's my point. We, mankind, have lost the capacity for love. We must face the fact, Doctor. Let's wait to acquire the capacity, or if it's really beyond us, wait for the deliverance that will come to each of us anyway without playing the hero. Personally, I look no further. Here, it is difficult to discern what exactly Rambert is referring to when it comes to this passage. Is he referencing the fact that he is personally resigned to possibly never seeing his wife again? Or is this a critique on what Rambert perceives as the lack of love in Rieu and Taru? Either way, this is the first time since his impassioned arguments as to why Rieu should write a letter of exception for him to leave Iran that we find Rambert focused on something other than himself. There is a tension in the passage between humanity's loss at love and the resigned nature of the passage's conclusion, where he mentions that he will not play the part of the hero. While this seems troubling that Rambert chooses not to be the hero, I would argue that this is a crucial point in the novel where he is going to inform Rieu and Taru that he has decided to stay in Iran and fight the plague. Thus, one could argue that by doing so, Rambert is rising above the selfish reasons of staying as a way to put on airs as a hero, and now he genuinely means that he will throw himself headlong into the fight without regards for status from those around him. Thus, as I have postulated, with the exceptions of Grand and Cotard, Rieu, Penelo, Taru, and Rambert all come to represent different aspects of Camus's use of empathy in the plague. It is something that, one could argue, fails to materialize, or Camus decides to shift the focus completely away from the empathetic individual when he comes to Jean-Baptiste Clément's in his final novel, The Fall.
Okay, thanks a lot, Peter, for that. There's a lot of silent clapping for you because everyone's still got their microphones on. Right, we've got about 15 minutes, and then we're going to launch into the big discussion. So we'll just raise some of the points that came up in the comments. So Eric asked, you can't hear me, can't you, Peter?
No, I can hear.
Okay, right. So Eric asked, are there any stock characters from the Greek plays that fit the characters in the plague? He also talked about lack of empathy in Panelou's sermon. Megan liked the link you made between Cartesian doubt and empathy, and she wants to know if you can explain this with reference to Taru's past. And Stephen said, do you do justice to Panelou's humbling and apparent change between the sermons? So there's three questions there. So there's Eric's stock characters in the Greek plays and lack of empathy in the sermon. What do you think?
Honestly, I don't know. I'm probably weakest in ancient Greco-Roman plays. So that is something that I'm gonna definitely have to go back and look at. Especially if I'm going to be, you know, planning on expanding this into a monograph. I mean, this is just, you know, a 20-minute snapshot of, you know, a much, much larger chapter. So short answer, Eric, I don't know. But you know, it's going to be tacked onto the list of things that I need to research.
We could tie in Stephen and Megan's comment. No, Stephen and Eric's second follow-up comment about the lack of empathy in the sermon and Panelou's humbling and apparent change between the two sermons.
Well, I think, Steve, that's a great question, and it's something that I have wrestled with ever since I picked the plague up, you know, almost 25 years ago. And I think anyone who comes across the novel has to kind of wrestles with this idea. And I'm really upfront with my students when I teach the plague and we get to Panelou, and you know, Panelou is probably the most complex character, and a great, you know, a scene that is the source of great debate for pretty much an entire lecture period is Panelou's death. You know, I bring up the idea of when Panelou dies, you know, there's that imagery that he dies and he kind of turns his back the last time he sees Ryu before the night, and when he dies, he turns his back, he clutches the crucifix. And I tell my students, really, there are kind of two ways to look at this. Either he clutches the crucifix, and I think this first reason is the kind of traditional interpretation, that when Panelou clutches the crucifix, Panelou knows that he's going to die. He knows that he's going to die, and he knows he's going to meet his maker. And so he, by clutching the crucifix and fixating on the crucifix, he sees himself in Jesus's terms, right? It's Jesus died for my sins, and now I'm going to die, and I'm going to meet Jesus. And it's a way for me to affirm my faith. And, you know, probably 90%, 95% of my students sit there and nod their heads like, oh, absolutely. And then someone will be like, yeah, my grandma did this. And I tell them that part of the beauty of not just the novel or the way that Camus structures the novel, but part of the beauty with how Camus writes, whether it's The Stranger, The Plague, The Fall, the plays, the short stories, is he always leaves something open for interpretation. And so I tell my students, and I kind of play devil's advocate, I tell my students, I don't think Panelou is clutching the crucifix as a reaffirmation of his faith. He's clutching the crucifix and he's basically in his mind damning God. You know, why have you forsaken me? In that moment, he does see himself like Christ. He does see himself as a martyr. And he dies. I argue that he dies. Or when I bring this up with my students, I argue that he dies at least as an agnostic, if not an atheist. He feels that he's been abandoned by God. He feels that he's been betrayed by God. So he clutches the crucifix in anger. And my students will say, well, what's your basis? My basis is that after Jacques Othion dies, Ryu is emotionally bothered by watching Jacques die. He leaves. He can't bear to witness. He leaves and he goes and sits on the bench on the playground, right? After Jacques dies, Panelo, who tries to basically hockey hip check him in the doorway to prevent him from getting outside, goes out and says, you know, a really kind of asinine, preachy sort of, oh, we're fighting for the same thing. You know, we believe in the same thing. And Ryu snaps and says, no, we aren't. And I refuse to believe in a God who allows for the needless suffering of children.
Yeah.
Period. And so and he gets up and he walks away. And I tell my students, if you're Panelo, if you are the type of person that Camus portrays Panelo has basically gotten his way his entire life. He tells the congregation, you need to say five Hail Marys and five Our Fathers and you'll be absolved of your sins. The congregation falls to their knees and they do as they are told. Ryu is the only person who basically, you know, argumentatively puts Panelo in check, and that I think sows the seeds of doubt that causes him to question his belief. And I'm not saying that Panelo does die as an atheist or as an agnostic. I'm saying it's possible that for the first time in his life, he questions what he has so blindly followed, what he has so blindly believed. And of course, I tell my students that the, you know, like I said, the conventional reading is that, you know, he does see that he's going to die and he is preparing his soul. He's preparing his mind for it, for his death. So.
That's really interesting, Peter. And I like how you create alternative interpretations to conventional ones. I still lean toward the conventional one, but I will add another point in your favor is that questionable case verdict about mm-hmm. Panelou when he dies. What does that mean theologically? Well, it could mean he's agnostic, or at least that it's unclear whether he's still a theist. Now, I think he is, and I think he does change character and becomes more compassionate and empathetic than he had been in his incredibly arrogant and awful first sermon, but it's a matter of interpretation, and I like the way you raise alternative interpretations.
Thank you.
I think that it's interesting that you've basically got three, and this is something I think Megan's brought in as well, is that Panelou can be an atheist now, he can be an agnostic now, or he could be a different kind of Christian. So Eric earlier was talking about Lutherans and Southern Baptists or whatever, and he'd mentioned in the comments just now about heresy. So this new thought about the plague, his new experiences, he could have retained his faith in God and his basically faith in Christ as a Christian, but he's now having a different theology to a different response to human condition on earth and relationship to God. I just got a thumbs up from Eric. So didn't get one from Stephen or Megan, but... One out of three is not bad. So Peter, yeah, the three ones, atheist, agnostic, or a new Christian, not denomination, but theology, maybe, that's more earth-based, loving, fellowship of man, all those kind of things that Eric talks about.
For what it's worth, just a quick point, I don't mean to monopolize, there's a new fashionable development in contemporary philosophy of religion called skeptical theism, in which theists give up on claiming knowledge of how to reconcile, for example, God's perfection with evil, while still maintaining that there must be a way, right? And so it's a very humble kind of theism. And I'm not real familiar with it, but it's certainly lacking in the confidence and arrogance of, you know, oh, God's punishing us for our sins kind of stuff that's so inhumane and unempathetic.
When we compare the situation in which Panelou dies to the figure of Christ on the cross, there is always the moment of being in doubt just before the imminence of death. And it can also be interpreted as a as an element of being Christian, the crisis that Panelu has to go through in order to be a true believer, because he realizes that the whole rational spectrum of things he thought about God and about being a human being are incomparable to the experience of going through suffering and going to die in a short moment. So maybe this is the moment where he realizes that it didn't really protect him, the whole faith he had before, from this experience that he's going through. So it could be also interpreted not as an agnostic thing or even atheist, but as a necessary moment of becoming a true Christian.
Interesting.
I think at this juncture, if we thank Peter again for his...
We have a very exciting announcement. All episodes of Albert Camus Radio will now be sponsored by Vectus Consulting. Vectus Consulting specializes in consulting humanities departments, so they're very good fit for Albert Camus Radio. Vectus Consulting specializes in growing humanities departments, retaining current students enrolled in your humanities department, and raising the visibility of your humanities department. We are very happy to have Vectus Consulting as a supporter. They can be found at vectusconsulting.org. Vectusconsulting.org.